Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So forget for a minute the controversial movie that was shown to more than 1,000 NYPD trainees, painting the Muslim community with such a broad brush. Somebody has to analyze the real intelligence about actual terrorist threats to New York City. The person in charge of that is my next guest and says the Al-Qaeda threat is real but mutating after the death of Osama bin Laden. Mitchell Silber, Director of Intelligence Analysis for the NYPD, has a new book based on his work called The Al-Qaeda Factor, Plots Against the West. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Director of Intelligence Analysis. What does that mean you do for a living?
Well, what that means is that I oversee all of the analysis of any terrorism investigations that are going on at NYPD. We have a cadre of about 36 civilian analysts who are looking at all the data and information coming in, as well as a unit that looks on the internet, so a cyber component to it as well.
So the people who work for you are not police officers or detectives per se. They're more information analysts who come out of academia, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, it's a mix. We do have very talented detectives who have language capabilities who work for me, but the large part of the analytic cadre comes from academic institutions, may even come from the Washington intelligence community, but want to be back in New York.
You basically divide the book into three categories: Al-Qaeda command and control plots, like 9/11, Al-Qaeda suggested or endorsed plots, and Al-Qaeda-inspired plots. Why divide up terrorist plots in that way?
Well, I guess I'm looking at it from the terrorist, the counterterrorism practitioner. And one of the questions that we're always looking at when we're trying to thwart the next plot is, you know, what exactly was Al-Qaeda's role in the plot? Because if we understand that, that maybe helps guide us where to look and where some places for disruption might be.
In doing your research, did you learn anything about 9/11 itself that most people don't know and might be worth mentioning, adding to our body of knowledge?
Yeah, absolutely, Brian. I think one of the things that I learned that I didn't know, like most other people, I thought that all of the 19 hijackers, in a sense, radicalized in the Middle East, and that's where they were produced. Well, it turns out that 3 out of the 4 pilots, so really the essential members of the plot, actually were university students living in Hamburg, Germany, speaking German, speaking English, and essentially where they radicalized was Hamburg. The other thing that was very interesting that I learned was that they actually were looking to go fight in Chechnya. And it was only a circuitous or fortuitous meeting on a bus with someone who said, you know what, you don't want to go to Chechnya, try and go to Afghanistan. That's where you get some good training. So it really was not a definitive thing that it would end up in an Al-Qaeda camp.
So that's about some of the 9/11 participants, the pilots, I guess.
Yeah, that's
of
right.
Of the planes, right, themselves.
Mohammed Atta and others.
And yet that's part of a pattern that's very important, I think, to protecting New York, which is that there are people who are radicalized in the West, not just in the Middle East or Afghanistan or wherever you may think of as the height of the geographical center of this kind of radicalism.
That's right. I think that was really an insight that changed a little bit the way that we looked at the 9/11 plot, but also gave renewed emphasis on our focus that individuals do radicalize in London, in Madrid, and in New York City.
And what radicalizes them here typically, and how different is that from what might radicalize somebody in London?
Well, actually, I mean, we have, as you know, good relationships and, in fact, an officer stationed in London. So we're very in tune with what's going on there. There's not much difference in terms of what's radicalizing people in London or in New York. And it's a couple things. Number one, there's a narrative of political grievance. People use that Samuel Huntington idea. There's a war against Islam, and they can look at Afghanistan or Iraq or Arab-Israeli conflict as a series of grievances that might mobilize them. But there's also an ideological component to it, and it's a minority view, but it's a literalist interpretation of Islam that says that under certain conditions, violence is obligatory. And when you combine those two, it's a really volatile mix.
As I said, you divide the book into three categories: Al-Qaeda command and control plots, like 9/11, Al-Qaeda suggested or endorsed plots, and Al-Qaeda inspired plots. In those command and control plots, In addition to 9/11, you only have two others, the Richard Reed shoe bomber attempt in 2001 and one called Operation Overt in 2006. What was that one?
So that's the one where a bunch of individuals in the UK are taking Gatorade bottles in which they have filled it with hydrogen peroxide. They're going to take batteries that are hollowed out and a disposable camera. And in the plane, they are going to assemble these devices so that they can take down nine flights that are coming from the UK to North America simultaneously over the Atlantic. And the idea was that all of these different components, batteries, Gatorade bottles would be so benign looking that they could get them on the plane. And that's why you can no longer take liquids on the plane.
How far did that ever get?
Well, they had actually made working models of those devices. They were in direct communication with Al-Qaeda. And essentially, the plot was disrupted when it seemed like they may take a test run over the Atlantic. And essentially, U.S. and British intelligence didn't want to take a chance that they might miss the test run. It might be the real thing.
And is that it? Just three Al-Qaeda-controlled plots against the West? You don't count the U.S. embassy bombings in Africa or the USS Cole in Yemen because they weren't on Western soil? Or what? Why just three in that category?
Right. Well, I mean, I was specifically looking at it from the West. So something like the USS Cole and the Africa bombings were excluded because, again, I'm looking at it to some degree from the New York City perspective. What is the environment that's like New York? Well, London's like New York. Toronto's like New York. Madrid, Los Angeles. Looked at those plots. But there's good news to this story. The good news is that because coalition forces, because the drone strikes have taken away Al-Qaeda's sanctuary in Afghanistan, they moved to Pakistan, and it's much harder to run a command and control plot where you've got people communicating.
Mitchell Silber is my guest on WNYC, Director of Intelligence Analysis for the NYPD and author of a new book based on his work called The Al-Qaeda Factor, Plots Against the West. We can take phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You believe if the Al-Qaeda core in Afghanistan and Pakistan fades away because of the death of bin Laden and drone strikes, it could become even more dangerous by metastasizing and spreading. That decentralization has been going on for years already before the death of bin Laden, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And I think that two plots that really awakened us to this were the issue with the underwear bomber, where suddenly an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen, one that we thought only had regional grievances, decides that, lo and behold, they're actually going to attack the U.S. homeland by putting Abdul-Muttalib on a plane heading to New York, to the United States. And then secondly, when we had the Pakistani Taliban, another group we thought only had regional ambitions, suddenly sends an individual, Faisal Shahzad, into Times Square on a busy spring night in May 2010. So now all of these affiliates and allies also seem to be inclined to attack the U.S. homeland.
Why did they change from a regional agenda to an anti-U.S. agenda, an action agenda, in your opinion?
Couple reasons. I think for these terrorist groups, they realize that in order for them to get a certain amount of attention and essentially get into the major leagues of terrorist groups, there's nothing like attacking the homeland. That really puts them on the radar and boosts them from a recruiting standpoint, from a prestige standpoint, and potentially even from a fundraising standpoint. So it really moves them up a few notches.
There's been a lot written about how bin Ladenism as an ideology is declining precipitously worldwide. The mass Arab Spring uprisings have little or nothing to do with that worldview. It's believed Muslims worldwide have realized Al-Qaeda plots kill more Muslims than anyone else and are basically not in their interest. According to, you know, many books and people's descriptions, that's become conventional wisdom. How much do you agree or disagree with it?
I think in general, the trend lines are going the right way. People have become disenchanted with the ideology and also more focused on local issues. If you think about individuals in Egypt who might have otherwise been attracted to Al-Qaeda, and historically Egyptians have made up one of the largest components in Al-Qaeda, they're now dealing with regional and local issues in Egypt. They're potentially running for elections and trying to manage their own affairs locally. So that's another reason I think the Arab Spring is taking a little bit of the steam out of bin Ladenism.
Let's take a phone call. A former New Yorker, Samir, calling from Canada. Do I have that right, Samir?
Samir? Yes, Brian. I used to live in New York City, and I was fed up with police corruption, so I moved away. So my question to this guest is a few questions. Like Bill Maher, the comedian, said, you know, the internal corruption and graft inside the police department is so intense that they always use these excuses to justify, to cover up and distract from their own criminal activities. And number two, this is what our president said. You carpet bomb entire Iraqi villages, and then you leave orphans, and you leave widows, and then you come around and say, this orphan is growing up, and say, who killed my dad? And then, you know, they rise up and take revenge, and then you call them terrorists. So, I mean, none of this is mentioned in his books, and he's just justifying his, you know, criminal activity that goes on in the police department across the board and the military industrial infrastructure that keeps, you know, getting new excuses for new wars. So if it's not blacks, it's going to be Muslims, one day. Not Muslim, it's Hispanic. Now, is this guest of yours, is he going to take some proceeds from his book and alleviate some of the intense 60% unemployment among American Muslim youths?
Samir, thank you for your call. All right, so he's painting with a broad brush there, obviously. But let me ask you a serious question that I think is at the heart of it. Are there things that the NYPD does? Are there things that the military-industrial complex, as he calls it, does, including, you know, let's say drone strikes, for example, which I think are radicalizing some people now, even as they are intended to kill the leaders of al-Qaeda, that have backlash effects that you have to be careful of?
Yeah, I think some of these tactics, though effective, are to some degree double-edged swords. You know, we've seen that drones have been tremendously effective in really eliminating, taking off the battlefield, the top tier of al-Qaeda leadership. However, anytime there's a drone strike and other individuals are killed or wounded in the strike, it potentially provides a grievance for someone else. But there really has to be a cost-benefit analysis when you can take out a top leader of al-Qaeda versus, unfortunately, what's called collateral damage.
Is that part of your job as an intelligence analyst, to come up with some metrics that look at potential gain versus potential radicalization or other kinds of blowback, and then advise, I don't know if you advise the NYPD on that, or then the NYPD advises the CIA or the Pentagon or whoever it is?
Yeah, I think we have to be tremendously sensitive to these issues and keen to identify what might be a radicalizing or a mobilizing event, and essentially looking at drone strikes or whether it be the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia, which might trigger people of Somali heritage to mobilize to violence. All these are the different trend lines that we have to keep an eye on, and our analytic cadre does, as well as the detectives, to make sure that there's not something that's triggering radicalization of violence that we're unaware of.
Has there ever been an instance where you or maybe Police Commissioner Kelly spoke to somebody in the Obama administration or before that the Bush administration and said, look, this war policy that you're pursuing, the way you're pursuing it, may actually endanger New York more than protect it?
You know, we have ongoing and frequent conversations with the federal government on a variety of different levels. I think one of the things that we're useful in is that we see these trend lines on the ground, and we can pass that to the federal government. And essentially seeing an individual like an Anwar al-Awlaki, we picked up someone like that and his radicalizing ability and passed that on to the federal government. So we are seeing trend lines sort of at the local level and passing that on a regular basis.
Mitchell Silber, my guest on WNYC, Director of Intelligence and Analysis for the NYPD. He has a new book called The Al-Qaeda Factor, Plots Against the West. We'll continue in a minute, including more of your calls and comments, 212-433-WNYC, or post online to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Mitchell Silber, Director of Intelligence Analysis for the NYPD. He has a new book based on his work with the department called The Al-Qaeda Factor, Plots Against the West. And you were just telling me during the break that New York is not only a prime target for homegrown terrorists in the United States, it's a prime producer. What did you mean by that?
Well, it seems that since 9/11, there have been more than two dozen individuals who lived in New York at certain periods of their life who then went on to get involved in Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism. And this was something that I think underscores much of why we're doing what we're doing at NYPD. Even someone like a Samir Khan, this was the individual who was responsible for Inspire magazine that had such witty titles as How to Build a Bomb in the Kitchen of Your Mom. He was with Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen when al-Awlaki was killed in a drone strike a number of months ago. But this was someone who lived in Queens and spent some significant period of his life there.
So do you get local intelligence mosque by mosque, neighborhood by neighborhood? How does that work?
It really goes investigation by investigation. And sometimes on the periphery of an investigation, you may meet someone or become aware of someone who's actually more concerning than the original investigation. And that might lead you to someone like a Jose Pimentel, who was arrested a few months ago for building that bomb in the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Is there a good program in place for monitoring all the mosques in the city to see which ones are developing radicalized cells?
You know, it's interesting, Brian. Really, since 9/11, a lot of the way radicalization has happened has moved out of formalized religious institutions, partially because of people's fear that they may be monitored, and partially because you've got a group of people who are hatching a conspiracy here. So the way we go about it is that we open up an investigation based on a lead, and that investigation allows us to continue for 90 days or maybe 1 year if it's a more significant investigation, and we're able to look at a group of people and determine whether it looks like they're turning to violence and there's some possibility of a criminal act.
Do you have undercover folks trying to gather intelligence on all the mosques so you can analyze the risk?
You know, again, it's not, you know, mosque focused. It's really it's an investigation focused. But, yeah, we do use undercovers and confidential informants. These have been tremendously useful. For example, two summers ago in detecting two individuals from New Jersey who were looking to go overseas and join al-Shabaab in Somalia, a designated terrorist group, only by the utilization of an undercover officer who fit in and in a sense was sort of the third leg of their conspiracy, would we have detected them?
But your point is that the mosques are not the focus of your investigations unless there's an actual investigation that leads you to an actual mosque?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if there was an institution that in and of itself was involved in some criminal activity, we're not prevented from investigating it. But I think that's unfortunately one of the notions that came out of some of the recent exposure out there is that this is a mosque by mosque focus effort when it's really not. It's really a potential criminality focused effort, which may take you to any number of places.
I think there was some concern about things happening in the Moroccan community in New York.
Well, you know, again, one of the ideas is that the analysts are going to be looking overseas at different trends, as we were discussing earlier before. So in 2003, there was an attack in Casablanca. In 2004, there was a devastating attack in Madrid. 191 people were killed, and the primary conspirators in that plot were individuals of Moroccan descent who were living in Madrid. So I think what NYPD did was ask ourselves the question, is there a Moroccan community in New York City? Is radicalization a big deal in that community? Is this something we need to be concerned about or not? So I think it was really that was sort of what led us to that question.
And there was, after the AP articles that I think you were referring to a minute ago with some of the information out there, kind of a backlash in the Moroccan community and among a lot of Muslims in general who got the impression that the NYPD is doing surveillance mosque by mosque on kind of a citywide fishing expedition.
Yeah, and again, you know, it was unfortunate the way that coverage went. But, you know, as Commissioner Kelly has said before, and we're following leads wherever they may take us, in this case, asking ourselves the question, is there a higher component of radicalization based on trends and real live attacks that happened overseas?
Mitchell Silber, the Director of Intelligence Analysis at the NYPD and the author now of The Al-Qaeda Factor, Plots Against the West, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Jim in Glen Rock, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Interesting guest. And first, I wanted to preface it. I respect anybody who helps defend us and our security for future attacks. But my one concern was whether the author needed any special permission, because it seems like a lot of the information being discussed could be borderline classified information.
Right. It's a good question. Did you need clearance, and why put this in book form? Are you informing terrorists as you inform the American public?
Yes, absolutely. This was, somewhat unconventional in the sense having someone in position write a book. But the idea was that if the information had to be in the public domain, trial transcripts, media, so that it was regularly available, and anything that might be known that wasn't available in the public domain couldn't be included in the book. And really, the purpose of the book is to inform policymakers, practitioners, people in the academic realm who are looking at and trying to understand what really is the nature of the Al-Qaeda threat, and only by really digging deep to understand the genesis of plot and the way they got executed, can you really be informed on that issue?
Greg in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Greg.
Yes, hi, Brian. Big fan. I have a question for your guest, bringing it very local. As a New Yorker, I remember 9/11 like most of us do. I also have friends who are Muslim, etc., like most of us do as well. My question is, what's your guest's opinion on the 60 Minutes episode that aired several months ago, where the police commissioner was interviewed and he discussed surveillance cameras that automatically detect packages left behind and stuff like that? What's his opinion?
Familiar with the episode?
Yeah, familiar with the episode. And, I think essentially New York City has looked at the experience of other cities around the world, London in particular, and really tried to adopt best practices and utilize them here in New York City. One of the ways that the cameras were so effective in London, and in fact it's one of the plots that I talk about in the story, is that everyone remembers that on July 7th, 2005, there were four suicide bombers in the London Tube and a bus. 2 weeks later, there are actually five more attempted suicide bombers. Now, it turns out that their devices didn't have the right mix of explosives, so when they pressed the button, there was a loud pop, and the devices actually didn't explode, thankfully. But what then happened is that these five individuals all made a run for it. And this is really where the cameras came in, because from the cameras, they could go bus by bus, tube by tube train, identify the individuals, and essentially arrest all five of them. Even as one got as far as Italy. So that's really one of the ways that the cameras came into place. And the ability to identify packages left behind is just another more advanced iteration of that.
Greg, thank you. If you've only found a couple of dozen, was I think the number that you used, New Yorkers in all the years since 9/11 who have been radicalized enough to consider or plan actual violent acts against other Americans, it's actually, a few things come to mind. One, it's a needle in a haystack from an intelligence point of view. Two, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of all the people here in New York. And so we shouldn't broad brush communities at all, because it shows that the vast, vast, vast majority are not into any such thing.
Yeah, I think generally that I would agree with that. And this really is a problem that for the number of people involved, unfortunately, has a disproportionate effect. One individual with three pipe bombs on the New York City subway would change the way we all look at, getting on the subway. Yet we're charged with finding that person and making sure that doesn't happen. That is true. It's good news in a sense that it's only two dozen people from New York. But again, we're also concerned about the people from the outside who come to New York who might want to do something, sort of operative sent from overseas.
The Al-Qaeda affiliates overseas, most in the news these days, I think, are Boko Haram in Nigeria, and Al-Shabaab in Somalia, both very dangerous in their regions, but you work for the NYPD. Do you see these as any threats to New York City?
We do. We absolutely do. And I think one of the, again, one of the benefits by looking at some of these plots historically is that we saw other countries had the experience where they let individuals go overseas and train with particular groups because they believed it was a one-way ticket. In the UK, they let an individual go overseas and train in Pakistan because they thought he wouldn't be coming back. Lo and behold, they met this foreign terrorist group and they were directed back to London. And in fact, that was the leader of the July 21st or even July 7th plot. So we have to be concerned about someone who may go overseas and train with a Boko Haram, with an Al-Shabaab, and then come back, be directed to come back to New York. And clearly New York City is in the bullseye in the United States when it comes to terrorist plots.
Could that analysis be used as a case for ending the Afghanistan war? Like, why have 100,000 American troops putting their lives at risk in a big war in one place? If Al-Qaeda's core is increasingly irrelevant, maybe just get out there and, to the extent that the military is necessary, use special forces on specific targets.
Yeah, I think that should give us some peace of mind that as the drawdown happens in Afghanistan and the U.S. footprints looks exactly like that, special forces and drones, that that may very well be sufficient to prevent Al-Qaeda from reconstituting in Afghanistan. But it still implies that there needs to be an effort on the home front to try and detect these individuals before they go overseas, because you don't want to be dependent on trying to find them once they've come back and have been trained or ready to go.
Mitchell Silber, Director of Intelligence Analysis for the NYPD, new book called The Al-Qaeda Factor, Plots Against the West. And Shell in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Thank you, Brian. Mr. Silver, last week with the controversy regarding Commissioner Kelly and the film The Third Jihad, it got me a little curious. I went to the internet and watched the film. And two things that I noted, and I'd like to ask your opinion. One, I didn't think that the film was in any way, I mean, I understand that it was controversial, but I don't think that it was necessarily wrong. It could be very well right. And the role that the commissioner played in the film, I didn't feel that it was controversial either, and he may very well be right as well. So what's all the hoopla?
Well, I've to some degree have been, thinking about that a lot myself. But, essentially on this one, the mayor's made some comments. The police commissioner has, the deputy commissioner for public information. So I think I'm going to let their comments stand on the record for the NYPD's view.
Well, Chell, thank you. But have you seen any part of the movie?
Yes, I have seen the movie.
We had the narrator, Dr. Jasser, on the show on Friday defending it as factual, not biased. Do you think it's getting a bad rap?
I think you have to understand what was the intention of its utilization. I think for individuals who wanted to present the full spectrum of all of the different components, different groups, different ideologies that underpin what they were calling quote-unquote radical Islam, I think they probably have a lot of fact in terms of the different groups. In terms of putting them all together and making it look like a monolithic threat, I think there's probably some more precise analysis that could go on that and really get down to a little bit more of the granular level.
So what do you think of it in terms of its usefulness as training material or something that people who would eventually be working for you, let's say, might have seen along the way?
Yeah, again, I think, on this, I'm going to let the commissioner's, comments stand on that. I think that, it's a movie and it had a particular viewpoint, but I'm going to let their comments stand on its value as a training.
Besides the continuous loop that it was on, was it screened for you in any other context, like an executive development meeting or anything like that?
No, I only saw it on my own private time.
Who organized its showing at the NYPD?
Again, I think from what I understand, this was shown as sort of on the side of some type of administrative duty while people were filling out some forms. It was not any part of any official training material.
How do you train people who work for you?
Well, fortunately for me, most of the people that we're bringing on board actually come pretty well trained, because we're actually recruiting people who have spent time in academia studying the Middle East, studying South Asia and Africa. So we're actually hiring them in their capability as an analytic role, because they know the details and the nuances of the regions, of the ideology, of the language.
Do you think having a movie like that shown to people who are training to work for you makes it harder for them to do a good job, because an overbroad characterization of the Muslim community like that kind of fogs up their brains with prejudice and therefore makes it harder to gather specific intelligence?
I think precision is the key, and in many ways that's really what I was seeking to do in my book, because I think a lot of what drove me to write the book was that so many things had been called al-Qaeda with sort of a broad label, and what did that really mean? It's easy to give something a broad label, but only by going into the weeds and dissecting these things and almost doing an anatomy of them can you get down to the view of what it actually was, and really you want to present it as just the facts. So I think, you know, unfortunately with this movie, it seems to have gone, you know, beyond that in its portrayal. So, you know, in the end, I tend to try and get down to the weeds and the precision.
So does it leave you in a position of having to untrain, if that's the right word, anybody?
Well, you know, we have a special unit that is responsible for training, and, you know, as far as I know, they do a pretty comprehensive job. So I think that they will probably continue on their, you know, normal curriculum of educational material.
Relating to our earlier thread then, do you think the NYPD itself at this point contributes inadvertently sometimes to the radicalization of any Muslims in the city?
Well, I think, unfortunately, this event, based on some of the coverage, has grown legs of itself, and to some degree, the detail seems to be lost in the coverage, and unfortunately, as it bounces around on the radio waves, you know, is having a bit of a negative effect.
And do you how should the department address that?
Well, I think the first thing that's going on, to my knowledge, is just a better understanding of when was it used, how was it used, where was it used, and get to the bottom of that. And then, you know, as has been said, you know, we do have a very robust outreach program, a very robust community affairs program. So I think dialogue with the community is always helpful to give people an opportunity to raise their grievances and give the department an opportunity to address them. And we may not get 100% there, but at least by airing them, there's a better understanding of where different parties stand.
So before you go, a couple of things. How big do you see the homegrown terrorism threat in New York as being today compared to, say, 5 years ago?
You know, it's tough to really do a quantitative analysis of it. Unfortunately, I think it's probably more diverse, more spread out, and probably prone to smaller groups of individuals committing terrorist attacks or seeking to. I mean, we've seen this countrywide where there's been a proliferation of what you could call DIY, do-it-yourself attacks, or lone wolves, as people are calling it. So if we were looking for a needle in the haystack before of a group of 5 to 7 people, now we're looking for an even smaller needle in a larger haystack of maybe 1 or 2 people.
Do you think the most serious potential threat against New York since 9/11 was the Najib al-Azazi plot of 2009 to explode devices on subways?
I do, and you know, that's one of the plots that I cover in the book, and in many ways it's probably the one that's most important to New Yorkers, because it essentially says a few things. It says an individual, or actually 3 individuals who grew up in Flushing, Queens, because Zazi had 2 compatriots, could decide that they radicalized the violence, and without any al-Qaeda recruiter living in New York, they got up and decided that they would go fight overseas against coalition forces. They saw that as a grievance or something that they wanted to write. And then, not because, again, there was any al-Qaeda linkage, but they bounced from mosque to mosque in Peshawar seeking out some type of training. And then, lo and behold, very fortuitously, they link up with someone who said, I can get you training. And the next thing you know, they're linked to al-Qaeda and they're being asked if they'll be willing to participate in a suicide attack in New York City. So an abundance of fortuitous connections, intention that really formed in New York City, but capability-wise, this would have potentially look like the 7/7 attack in London with suicide bombers, the New York City subway.
Is there enough al-Qaeda left at this point for something like that to happen again in that way?
It's a great question, and one that actually I've been addressing as I talk about the book, is that clearly al-Qaeda has been hurt. They've lost significant members of their executive cadre. But really, what did the Zazi plot boil down to? Zazi himself was the only person to get training from al-Qaeda on how to make the hydrogen peroxide device. So can one person from New York or East London or Toronto make it to Pakistan and meet one or two people from al-Qaeda who has this technological capability? Sure, that can still happen. And then what it does, if that individual returns and recruits a few friends, you've got a serious plot on your hands.
And the death of bin Laden affects that how?
Not that much from an operational logistical standpoint. There have actually been people who have been removed from the battlefield who probably have a more important role, from an operational standpoint. Bin Laden was more, it seems like, the chairman who sent the strategic direction as opposed to the chief operational officer who's actually handling the day-to-day.
Do you work with the CIA, which is officially supposed to do international intelligence? I know that was one of the controversies in the AP story, was CIA officials working in New York City on domestic. But they're supposed to gather international intelligence. NYPD is now also gathering international intelligence. Do you coordinate or do you, in a way, compete?
No, there's no competition. I mean, really, you know, NYPD has liaison officers overseas, and they're looking to pick up trends overseas, and they're embedded with local police like Scotland Yard, among others. But, you know, we're relying on the CIA as the United States arm for intelligence collection overseas to inform us of how the threat is changing. So who's going to know what the latest is with al-Shabaab or al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or frankly, as things begin to shift, Hezbollah in Iran, but the CIA. So the fact that their information through various conduits gets to us is absolutely critical.
So last question. Do you have any tips for the public? We always hear the mantra, if you see something, say something. But that's very general. Anything more specific?
Unfortunately, Brian, you know, not much I can add to that. And in fact, you know, with the Faisal Shahzad Times Square bombing attempt, it was really, if you see something, say something, that and essentially save lives by providing the early tip that there was a smoldering car. You know, terrorism is a very technologically detailed and specific issue. And these individuals, by the nature of the event, they're trying to remain below the radar line. So it's tough for the average citizen to notice something. But, you know, if you see the suspicion, call into the line, and I can promise you that NYPD will react to that and follow up on it.
Mitchell Silber, Director of Intelligence Analysis for the NYPD. His new book is The Al-Qaeda Factor, Plots Against the West. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, New York's winter art scene. Fun, beauty, and controversy in the galleries and museums. Stay with us.